Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2019. And I think this is I've already lost count. This is the fourth night, and I think this is the second hangout. Yes, this is the second hangout. Yeah. So, and this is with Zurius or Zurius Music, who was banned from YouTube about just over a year ago. I think it was September last year. I mean, it was absurd. But there we are. I don't know if there's anything you want to talk about, you want to say about that, Zurius?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial.
Yes, welcome.
I guess you've all been here already. About the YouTube ban. It was actually in August when they targeted my channel. Although what happened was, to begin with, they just put. And by the way, for anyone that doesn't know, my YouTube channel was almost entirely just instrumental music. There was no, well, there are very few opinions expressed, really. What happened, first of all, that one track of mine got put into limited state, and the track was called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And that track was a collaboration with another musician called Alessar, who's a very talented guitarist. And they put that track into limited state. They denied my appeal. And what surprised me at the time was that track wasn't even political, and I was baffled by that. But then after they got one, they went for more, and more each time, and it was sort of coming in waves. And then until in August, not September, but as I recall, suddenly everything on my channel it wasn't put in limited state, but they gave me a. What they called a legal complaint. They claimed there'd been a legal complaint against the music on my channel. They didn't explain what the legal complaint was, so it wasn't properly legal because you're supposed to know what you're accused of and also who your accuser is. They claimed it was a legal complaint and banned my music, or at least banned my YouTube channel, almost entirely across Europe and also in Israel too, which kind of surprised me because I don't know what's all these European countries had in common with Israel. Possibly it's a sort of vague hate speech laws or something.
Sorry, I've accidentally highlighted a comment. I didn't mean to.
Oh.
Yeah, there we go.
I just read that instantly and I just wondered what he was talking about. So then, as an experiment, oh yeah, not only did they put this legal complaint against videos that I had public, they also did it against ones which I'd never shown anybody, completely innocent things. And to test it, I tried uploading a video which was just a black screen and silence, and they put the legal complaint against that too, even though that wasn't made public. I also did one that was made public too, and they put a legal complaint against that. And so it was, you know, they're basically just shutting down my channel, just taking away my ability to share my music with people.
It's weird. It's really weird. Because, I mean, obviously, what that was obviously somebody at YouTube messing around with you. And they could have just shut your channel down. But I think at that point, that was like a year ago, they were a bit more careful. I mean, nowadays, they just shut channels down for anything, for no reason at all. But back then, I think they were still at the stage where they were having to be a bit more subtle, and in your case they did it by just messing you around for quite a few months. I mean, I seem to remember you being frustrated with this problem for about 4 months, and then one day they just shut the channel down finally.
Yeah, I think it's like that thing, the totalitarian tiptoe, that they see what they can get away with, and if there's no pushback, then they can just do more and more. I actually remember I tried to ask Team YouTube on Twitter what was going on. And at first they said they would get back to me, and then they didn't get back to me. And so they wrote again, and then they just said, we can't give legal advice. We're not in a position to give legal advice, and that was the end of it. So I actually, I took one, because I got something like 120 emails from them in the space of 20 minutes when they decided to just put this complaint against everything that I've ever done. I actually took that to my MP, my Member of Parliament.
Yes, and I remember you telling me about this at the time. Yeah. Sorry, everyone, I'm just adjusting my camera because it seems to have gone out of focus. Doesn't ignore that. Just keep going.
And I showed her the email that they sent me, and she looked at it I mean, I explained the sort of, you know, the situation first. She just looked at it and straight away she said, this isn't legal. And I would hope that she's an expert in law. But she also didn't know what I could do about it, except, you know, hire lawyers to take on YouTube, which, of course, is not something any individual is going to want to do when you're placing down a massive corporation with, you know, untold amounts of backing.
At this point, this was when I got banned from Twitter at the end of September last year. And at this point, we were sort of grasping what we were up against and just, I mean, how absurd it was, how incredibly, I don't know what there's a word for this, like a complete lack of balance between the two sides. I mean, one side is a bunch of people who are on their own, no money, no backing, and the other side is a corporation with just infinite legal resources and all sorts of resources, and they can do what they like. And there is no way for those two sides to reach any kind of agreement, because one side has all the power.
Yeah, yeah, and they have no accountability. That's the thing. They're not actually accountable to anybody. They have a huge amount of power, and they're not accountable to anyone. That's why I actually went to see my MP, because I thought, well, if there's one organization which ought to be able to trump YouTube, it would be, you know, the government. And what's my point what's my point of contact with the government? Well, it's my MP. So I went to go and see her. She wasn't much help, but she was quite nice, at least. And she did eventually write me a letter back as well. But the letter was essentially saying, well, we don't know what we can do to help. There wasn't really anything in law to deal with this. And she thought I should seek legal advice. But then that means, you know, just handing over money to lawyers who aren't necessarily going to do anything. That's the unfortunate thing about lawyers, is they're not some sort of solution. They'll take your money, but they won't necessarily help. So yes, the situation is completely asymmetrical, and the
asymmetrical. That's the word. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for.
Right.
Thank you.
There's very little that we on our side can do about it. You know, that's broken my stream of thought. Now I'm going to have to. You say something.
Sorry. At that point we were realizing it's massive. Yes, and I am about to smoke, by the way, somebody asks. So, I mean, this is when I realized, okay, the only way that we're going to get our way is if we collectivize. And that means some kind of YouTubers union or a class action lawsuit against Google. Something has to be done, because they are destroying people's livelihoods, destroying people's work, destroying people's social media platforms, their standing, their stature, whatever, that they've built up. They're doing this with a complete free reign, the total and complete arbitrary reasoning, sometimes no apparent reasoning. This cannot be right. You can say it's legal. I don't care. It's not morally right. So, and I'm not saying, oh, therefore, how can it possibly be happening? I know why it's happening. It's because these corporations are so powerful, right? I'm not naive about this. But the point is, it's why are we tolerating this? It's not right. It's not moral. Therefore, we should do something about it. And what frustrated me, as I said in a stream last night, was how difficult it is to motivate anyone to just collectivize, basically, for this.
Well, it's difficult to know what we can do, really. I think, I had a kind of a sort of stoicism about it, in that, I've written music for a long time, so I know that any musical project that you start up will have its arc where it's popular and really, well, I mean, if it takes off, that is. Eventually, all bands sort of peter out, and I thought, well, perhaps this is just how, you know, Zorius music ends, through censorship, and that can be a sort of statement about art in itself, right? Although saying stuff like that, I feel really pretentious. But do you know what I mean? As it happens, I've kept writing music, but I'm using BitChute now to put my new music on. But I think, you know, looking at this in a more abstract way, in a more hypothetical way, it really illustrates, I think, the flaws of libertarianism. I think at this point it's kind of absolutely bloody clear that you just can't trust the free market with this sort of thing. This whole notion, I mean, it's poked holes in so many of the libertarian arguments.
I remember Molyneux got banned from PayPal and everyone was thinking, oh, what's he going to say about this?
Okay. Right. Yeah. I feel sorry for the guy because he's made his a name for himself. I mean, I feel sorry for him on multiple levels, but in terms of where his ideology is at, he's built his castle on this, you know, on the libertarian rocks, and they've just sort of crumbled away underneath them. So I mean, he made a video not so long ago about the awful year that he's had, and you know, a lot of people gave him a hard time about that, but you know, I didn't. Not that I'm that important, but I felt for the guy. But I also see that, you know, the crisis is not just the censorship which he's been put under, as we've all been put under, but the fact that this kind of illustrates the big problems with libertarianism and this notion that you can just you can trust these corporations, you can trust the free market. You know, it will always find a solution. And also the notion that these companies, it's like that they don't conspire to maintain their power in spite of whether that helps them financially or not. The libertarianism idea is that it's all just about money. They wouldn't just blanket ban people because that means less money for them. But the thing is, they're so huge, they don't give a damn.
Yeah.
It's
horrifically naive to think that this is about money.
Yeah, yeah. It's...
It always amazes me when people say things like, "Oh, they're killing their own platform by getting rid of us." No, they're not. They're if anything, they're making their own lives easier by getting rid of controversial content. They don't have to censor it anymore. They don't have to monitor it. Even if they did, it's not about the money. They've got the money. They've got masses of money. They don't. That's not an issue. It's not even a consideration for them. They can employ, I think it's 30,000 people on Facebook to monitor content. They can employ 10,000, I think it is, on YouTube to monitor content. It's not about the money. They're doing this for social power. That's what it's always been about, or at least certainly for the last 5 years. And, you know, just give up on the money thing. Let it go. You sound like a dick.
Yeah, and this is another, I think, one of the flaws of libertarianism is that, it's an abdication of responsibility for power. It's kind of saying, hey, we want to try and seize power if you don't, but let's all just be economic units. It's fine. We'll all be equal, you know, under the market in the way that we used to be equal under God, but, you know, the market will become the thing that equalizes us all. And it forgets that there are people that seek... The power is real, and if you don't seek power, there will be other people who are seeking power, and they'll wield it over you. And we've seen that happen with these corporations.
We'll come back to that later when we're talking about British politics, no doubt, because I know that you've got something to say on that matter, on that theme. But it does also show, and I met two people, I won't name them, but I met two famous centrists at the start of this year, and I was, I was saying to them, McCarthy was right. And the reason that he didn't go far enough, and that's why we're now in this situation now where we're all afraid of losing everything we've built, because these corporate, what's happened is the communists took over the universities, brainwashed one generation, that generation then brainwashed the next generation, and again, and then they, the SJWs of the millennials, are now in these corporations censoring you and me. So if McCarthy had gone farther in controlling communism and fighting communism, we now wouldn't be in this situation. But you don't want to go McCarthyite because you're afraid of power. And so guess what? Power is going to be wielded over you because you don't have the will to seize power.
Yeah, it's sad, really. It's like the sad fate of the libertarian is that they end up with someone that does believe in power. Afflicting. Well,
it's one of those things. It's like you may not believe in power, but power believes in you.
And this is part of the sort of, you know, the tragic view of man or of existence, perhaps, that there are certain things which won't go away, and power is a reality. It doesn't matter if it's like it seems to be at the heart of libertarianism this idea that if, you know, we won't seek power, you won't seek power, you know, we'll all just get on and it'll be fine. Well, it only takes a small group, maybe just even just two or more people, to upset that whole apple cart by seeking their own advantage at the expense of all the other dupes. And yeah, well, I mean, not that we've lived in a libertarian society, but there was a certain free market idealism to the internet in, you know, certainly in its early days. And that's just been we've seen how what a fallacy that is, and it's rather tragic.
It was there even at the start of social media, YouTube and Twitter, not so much Facebook, because it was always more, I mean, well, it was much less censorious than it is now, but it was always a bit more for just chatting to your aunt, you know, on Facebook. But Twitter and YouTube, you know, the free speech thing was pretty real there on those websites for a long time. I mean, no one really got banned from Twitter until 2016. You just didn't hear about it happening. I'm sure it did happen, but it wasn't like it is now, where if you say anything, if you're on Twitter with any kind of controversial perspective, you can expect to get banned. I mean, there are people who, and I'm not even talking about myself, I'm talking about other people, who should have on 80k, 100k on Twitter, but because they've been banned so many times and zeroed, they've only got 2k on Twitter, 4k. So it's that's happening all the time, every day. As for YouTube, yeah, channels just disappear, like yours did eventually. And so that, but for a while, I think it was basically real, that the free speech thing. Go on.
This is something. I mean, you asked. You sort of asked me, and I think you've asked other guests too, to sort of to do a sort of appraisal of the decade. But that's quite hard to do. But I do think the rise of social media is something which, I mean, it didn't really just happen in the 2010s, but it's certainly something which has characterized the whole decade. But even going before the 2010s, I still remember the idealism of the early internet was that it was going to be this free market of ideas, and for the first time everyone was going to have a voice, and it was going to have this incredible democratizing effect, and this was going to be great. I mean, this was going to be great because it would bypass the existing publishing houses and media power centers, and we would start getting a more realistic view of the world, a more true voice of the people. And so this is, you know, you could say this was perhaps as a kind of realization of the dream of the Enlightenment, perhaps, or even of progressivism generally. And then it's all just been turned on its head in this liberalism. Yeah. In this last decade, it's all just been even the last half of this decade, it's all been turned on its head because the things that people started saying and wanting to talk about were not the things that the people in power want us to be talking about. And then our ability to speak actually became a threat to them. And this was particularly from 2015 onwards. And 2015 was a sort of a critical year for me, because that's when I actually started up Zorius as a project. And I always count that as the year that I kind of officially became part of the dissident right. Prior to that, I mean, we're going back to, you know, 2010 itself. I think I was kind of apolitical. I think I was sort of brought as a kind of a normie lefty. I hadn't really thought things through very much. I mean, and that in itself is an interesting, you know, a statement about this decade, is that, I mean, you said that Facebook was not a place where people talk politics, but it actually became that for me. Because going back to the...
It did for me as well. What I meant, I just before I started my channel, I was having pretty hardcore debates, which I later anatomized on the channel, or dissected on the channel, autopsied on the channel. So yeah, I use it for that as well. But what I meant was simply that I don't think they ever intended it to be a place for that kind of thing. They intended it to be very much a social network where you're talking to your friends and schoolmates.
Oh, I see what you mean. That kind of stuff. It's it, well, I suppose the big difference between Facebook and Twitter, on Twitter you could follow existing celebrities and actually talk to them, which I think a lot of them didn't like and still don't like. Have you seen, who's that, Lily Allen left Twitter, you know, just to, in the last couple of weeks or something?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, after the Tory election win, she's... I mean, the absurdity of it. She stated as her reason for leaving Twitter that it gives voice to the far right. Yeah, that's what, yeah, that's what she said. But it's just because she was, probably having a lot of people laugh at her is what she didn't actually like. Laugh at her for being a sort of this, one of these champagne socialist Corbynistas.
All you need to know about that silly woman is that she advocates mass immigration and, you know, says that anyone who opposes multiculturalism is a vicious racist and all that, but she lives in the Cotswolds. And I'm sorry, but as far as I'm concerned, that basically ends it for her.
Yeah. But yeah, going back to this idea about, you know, what's happened in, you know, since 2010. I mean, if you go back to 20... It's almost like a different world at the very start of this decade. And as I said, at that time, I was sort of vaguely apolitical. I actually, at that time, everyone I knew, more or less, was a left winger, except perhaps my parents or something, and my eldest brother. But everybody I knew was a left winger. I was actually around people who were, you know, some of whom were left wing activists of different stripes, and it was actually through befriending them and then friending them on Facebook that I became much more political, because there they were expressing their, you know, left-wing opinions, and for whatever reason, I think even at that time I knew there was a problem with feminism, and I already thought that there was something iffy about climate change, and I didn't really like veganism and vegetarianism, and those things.
I like that. See, those are your clues as to there's something going on.
Yeah, well, that's where you start pulling at the thread. You know, I started arguing with those guys, and it didn't start in a bad way at first, but I started just stating disagreements, and I thought it was okay to have a disagreement because I was of this, that kind of mindset where, well, you know, freedom of discussion is, it's good to debate. You know, it's, we exercise our minds, we get better to the truth. And I've quite quickly learned that I wasn't really dealing with free thinking people at all, that they were all ideologues, and I wasn't really. And the longer this went on, the more I realized that I wasn't really part of their thing at all. I mean, I'd been around them, but I was not. I mean, I think one thing was that I was actually more intelligent than a lot of them were, and that they couldn't actually argue very well. And I was sort of running rings around them, but also learning a lot myself at the same time. And because, you know, from arguing with feminists, I found things like the Manosphere on the internet, and that was like a sort of like a gold mine of facts and information which sort of proved the feminist narrative wrong. And so I got quite involved with that for a while, as a place to, you know, pull arguments from and pull facts from, to argue with these people. But what really happened was, and this was all going on Facebook, because that's where I was friends with you. One by one, they're all sort of defriending me. I didn't really care. I think for whatever reason, I just didn't really. I was more interested in being committed to the truth than I was in having friends who were, well, stupid people, stupid ideological people. Who were a bit mean, actually. They'd often end up, even if the arguments would always be intellectual and always sort of philosophical or theoretical. But then I'd end up being the one with loads of insults thrown at me from them. And because some of these people were left-wing activists, they'd meet up and have their sort of, you know, discussion shops where they talk about what sort of activism they were going to do, sort of climate change or, you know, in one time they all went to the streets with chalk to sort of chalk left-wing slogans, for example. They did things like that around the town. But their meetups to discuss their activism were turning into shops where they were slagging me off specifically. And basically, where I'm going with this is that I basically lost an entire circle of friends by basically becoming right-wing. I didn't know I was becoming right-wing at the time. But a lot of people have this experience, don't they, where they get red-pilled and they either lose a friend or several friends. In my case, I lost an entire circle of friends. And that it's not nice losing a whole circle of friends, but I don't regret it at all at this point, because none of them were really. There's expressions in there, say what you think. Those that matter won't mind, and those that mind don't matter. I wasn't really working according to that, but I think there is some truth in that. If they're good friends, they'll accept you no matter what you think. And this lot didn't. And I was freed from them basically. But that sent me in a completely different direction, ideologically. Because I do remember one particular day, and I probably had maybe two or three left-wing friends left on Facebook at this point. When it just dawned on me that equality is the big lie, and it had never really occurred to me before, and I can't remember exactly when that happened. Maybe 2013 or something. I don't really remember. But certainly, I mean, I'd shedded a lot of that of the sort of left-wing baggage by this point. But it suddenly just dawned on me that to try and enforce equality in a society like wholesale means that a lot of people are going to get a lot of talented people are going to have to be hurt just to be brought down to an equal level. It seems obvious now, but at the time it was a bit of a bombshell for me because I just, like most people, take inequality as a kind of a universal good, as a given.
See, I read Harrison Bergenon in high school, secondary school, and it was just a short story. I think I can't even remember who wrote it now. Was it? Oh, anyway, it doesn't matter. But it makes this very graphically and brutally. It makes this point that in order to achieve equality, you have to hold some people back, which is literally physically done to people in this Kurt Vonnegut. Yes. Thanks. In this story, and also mentally, the more intelligent people have an implant which periodically emits some random noise to disrupt their thoughts, so that they can't have. I mean, it's really horrific, and so I was always aware of this thing that, well, and I don't really think I won't go into this much, but I don't think I applied it to left wing socialism. But I was just aware that we will only all be equal if the talented people are held down, are held back, and that's grotesque.
I've heard of that short story, and I haven't actually read it, but I only heard about it after, I would say, I became right wing. So after that, I remember the day, but I didn't keep a journal or anything or note when it was. But I remember writing.
Just before you go into that, I want to make the point that I didn't choose to read that story. It was given to us as a set text in the class that we all had to read. And I'm just thinking, I wonder if any teacher would give that text now because it's so telling about equality. But anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Please go on.
It's a really interesting point, and I'd never heard of that story, but now that you mention it, you remind me of an experience that I had recently, like really quite right this year actually, where my parents go to the theatre quite a lot, and I don't really, and I kind of thought, well, I ought to go to the theatre. It's a classic art form. And I'd probably mention that to them at some point. And then they told me, oh, we've got a spare ticket for this this play that we're going to see, and the production's supposed to be fantastic. And so I said, okay, I'll come along with you. And we went to see this play. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about this story. And it's called An Inspector Calls. Have you heard of that? Oh, sorry, you're smoking.
I've heard of it, but I don't know. You tell me more about it.
Oh, all right. Well, I mean, I'll have to go into some spoilers, I'm afraid. But anyway, so we went to this opera house near where we are. It's a lovely sort of Edwardian building. I liked all of that. We couldn't get very good seats, unfortunately, because the whole place was packed out. It's supposed to be this great production. And as we were sat there waiting for the show to start, busloads of teenagers were being brought into this thing. And I was talking to my parents. We thought this was a bit strange, all these young people coming to see this thing. And we sort of figured out, oh, yeah, that guy must be the teacher. This must be like a school trip. And there were hundreds of these teenagers. And then the play started. Oh, wait. I actually, the person sat next to us overheard me talking to my parents and said, yeah, this text is a GCSE text this year. So all these kids were being brought in to see this play, which is a GCSE text. And the play started, and I quickly realized that what I was watching was communist propaganda. Although it wasn't admitting that's what it was, I quickly tuned into the fact that, hey, wait a minute, this is like a massive left-wing psyop. And this was just right at the start. And it went on and on and on. It became more of a sort of blatantly obvious sort of ham-fisted left-wing propaganda of a brazen kind, utterly shameless. And, as if communism had never happened, you'd think, according to this thing. I was getting furious with it. I couldn't look at the screen at points. And I was so close to actually heckling, which is not really quite out of character for me. One thing that really stopped me from doing that was that I knew my parents would hate it if I did that. So I was just, I was just going out of my mind watching this thing, and it finally ended. I was like, fuck for that. And I had to say straight away what I thought of the play. And I didn't, to my parents, my mum was quite upset. No, she was not extremely upset, but she it was, that there they were. They'd offered to take me out to this play as a treat, and I hated the thing, and I was ranting about it all the way home. But that was my way of sort of venting about the thing. I sort of deconstructed all the fallacies in it, all the rest of it.
And when was that?
Oh, this was just a couple of months ago, a couple of weeks. Oh, not long ago. Anyway, I can't remember. And I looked up the play straight away on the internet to see who wrote it and what their angle was. And I, surprise, surprise, the play was written. It was written by a guy who'd actually been a propagandist during World War II and who went very left wing straight after World War II. And the first place it was shown was in 1945 in the Soviet Union. And so it was, as I had attuned straight, almost straight away, it was blatant communist propaganda. And what infuriated even more is they're showing this to all those young kids. They're showing this to all those young kids who are just going to get a mindful of, Western civilization bad,
There was a cool sound effect there, as if your synthesizer suddenly sprung up to life.
I was moving my hand around as I talked, and I banged the pop shield on my mic, which kind of defies the point of the thing. Yeah. it made that sort of springy sound, didn't it? Because it's on a kind of spring.
Yeah, it sounded like a distorted bass drum with a reverb. But yeah, but we'll maybe get into that kind of stuff later, briefly.
That was a bit of a long tangent, I admit. That's been on my mind ever since. But I felt vindicated when I found out the thing was actually written by a propagandist who had communist sympathies. And it turned out that the guy annoyed me this was being shown to kids. But also, as well as that, the production was fantastic. The sets were great, the acting was great, the lighting was great. Everything about this performance was fantastic. But it was the message that I couldn't get on with at all, and it was really just grinding me up inside. And also, I could feel that the audience or sections of the audience were going with it, and they laughed at the right points and sighed at the right points. I was like, no, this is altering things in your mind. This is manipulating you. Don't be manipulated. The part of the purposes of art is to let you go out of yourself for a time. So you can let go into something else, to have that ecstasis experience, and then and come back to yourself by the end, renewed, hopefully improved. I think that's part of the classic purpose of art is to give you those breaks from yourself so you can assimilate new insights and experiences without actually having to go through them. And that requires you to sort of let go. And this is, I think this is true of all forms of art. I think it's true, definitely true of music, theatre, cinema, whatever you can think of. Part of the purpose is to give you those experiences. But I couldn't let go into this play because straight away...
It's like, should I give myself up to be molested?
Yes, it was. It was a mind rape.
Yeah.
It was a mind rape when they're doing it to all these young kids and ferrying them in buses. It just made me so angry. And actually, I met up with some nationalists and recently, and one of them confirmed that their daughter was indeed studying this very same play. And you know, it would be okay if teachers showed them this stuff, but taught them, and this is communist propaganda. Now, sort of dissect and understand how this is a propaganda message, and that I think would actually set them up much better for life. But I very much doubt that that's what these teachers are doing. I think they are just like, you know, just, you know, shoveling this crap into them. But I tell you one thing I took away from it, because the play is very much about, you know, how the, well, the play is based, it's a work of fiction, right? But it, the whole thrust of it is that, you know, the upper classes don't listen to the suffering of the lower classes.
Oh, here we go. Marvelous. Never heard that before.
Thanks. Well, yeah, exactly. Never heard that before. But you know, I said quite loudly at the end of the thing, well, if that's happening today, it would be about a white girl getting raped by a Pakistani gang.
Exactly. I was going to say, what about Rotherham? What about it's just infuriating.
Yeah.
The people who applaud themselves for watching that play and agreeing with it and, you know, clapping along like middle-class seals to it will be the very people who think of Rotherham and think, what wine will we have for the dinner party this evening? And just change the subject. So it's fucking disgusting and infuriating.
Yes, yes. Thank God. I knew you'd understand.
Of course.
You'd understand.
Champagne socialism is just the worst thing in the world. And I hate it.
Yeah, thank God. Because my parents didn't quite understand why I was so irate at this thing. And my mum particularly, because, you know, my mum, she's still a woman. She doesn't like it. Well, of course she's still a woman, but I don't think women like it when men, you know, upset the apple cart and all, you know, to get all sort of worked up about political or artistic or philosophical things. It's like, you know, why can't we just have a nice time? You know, it was a nice play, wasn't it? I mean, what my mum tried to take away from the play was that, it was the main thing was about how the family didn't really understand each other, right? this family, this aristocratic family who, it turned, well, they weren't quite aristocratic. They're more like upper middle class, but they're bourgeois is what they were portrayed as. And it turns out that they all have sort of kind of secrets from each other, but my God, well, what family doesn't? And who actually wants to know?
The implication there is that middle class families understand one another better than these toffee nose people, or working class families understand each other better. And that is just bullshit. It's so stupid. It's not even worth considering, because as soon as you realize, well, there is no point being made unless you can say, yeah, the working class and middle class families understand each other better, then there can only be a stupid and misguiding point being made here.
Yeah, I think the main thing was my mum was trying to sort of look at it in a non-political way, whereas I was looking at it in a strictly political way because it was political propaganda. I think, you know, that was my mum's way of saying, well, let's, you know, let's try and keep it just about, you know, interpersonal relations. But that's not what the play was really about.
Yes.
The play was all about how awful, white middle class people are. But, you know, from the perspective of a very, very biased left wing. I mean, I wouldn't encourage anybody to go and watch that play, but not that production, because you'll be giving money to them. But certainly it'd be worth, you know, if you feel like having an analysis of some blatant communist propaganda, you know, which is veiled behind being a sort of social message that you're supposed to learn from, then yeah, maybe have a have a watch of an Inspector Calls. Because you know what? A lot of teenagers are watching that at the moment because it's a GCSE text. Oh, just in case not everybody knows, GCSE is a mandatory exam that people at state education have to do in the UK.
Well, private schools as well.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. All schools, in fact.
At the age of 15 or 16.
I know, when a formative worldview stage as well.
Yeah.
Although, hopefully some of those kids will rebel. But I don't think that's why teachers were taking them to watch such a play. And But I think hopefully some of them will put two and two together and sort of look at this recent election result in the UK and compare it to what was going on in that play. Because if that plays to be believed, then left-wing people, working class people should always be voting for the left because those are the ones that care about them. But we saw in this recent election that working class people sort of historically voted for a right-wing party, which is a massive sea change over here. It's a massive change of mindset.
Well, we can talk about that later. Let's return to the issue that the 2010s we're talking about, and that's how we I don't know how we got into an Inspector Calls, but anyway, that was a tangent. So let's return to the main thread. And any more thoughts that you have about this decade?
Oh, sure. I think we got into it because you mentioned this book, the short story, which explicitly spells out how horrible it is to enforce equality on a population. And I was talking about how I think it was maybe it was around 2013. I'm not exactly sure when for me, you know, as a sort of fully grown adult, really, it dawned on me that equality is just a load of, well, that equality is cruel, actually. And I'd never really realized that before because I never really thought about politics in great depth. And that's one thing that social media did. So go back to the decade thing. It was on Facebook that I got politicized. So although I was around left-wing activists, I was just part of their sort of kind of artistic scene, if you like. I was just sort of, you know, I was there for the community, if you can call it that. I was there for the events that they put on, you know, the fun stuff, not so much the politics. But I got to know them through that community and got to talk about their ideas on Facebook. So it was social media that kind of politicized me. And I don't think that I'm alone in that. I think social media has politicized a lot of people. And it's contributed, I think, to this polarization of politics, which has actually is another thing which I think marks this decade, that there's been a sort of a growing divide between left and right. Although I was listening to you talk to Black Pigeon Speaks, and there's this sort of trope that there's no difference between left and right, but I think there is a clear.
That's a really complicated matter to characterize, because on the one hand he's correct, and the other hand you're correct, and I think it's difficult. You give your perspective.
Well, I think that the difference between left and right is that the left prioritize equality above all else, and the right accept and or embrace hierarchy. And I think this is why libertarianism is still belongs on the right, because they at least accept hierarchy. They don't embrace it, but they do accept it. They accept that there will be unequal outcomes. But for the left, that's untenable. They can't have that there be ever be unequal outcomes. But then, of course, the big contradiction of the left is that they always use hierarchy to enforce equality. So they end up with oppression anyway from an elite which can't be removed. And that's what always happens. That's how their ideology always short circuits it. So as I see it, the way I see things, no clear thinking person should ever be on the left. Their whole worldview is mad, and it never works. I mean, is that too strong? You know,
I would want to speak to a leftist, because obviously, yeah. My default is to say, yeah, I can't really see how you can sanely believe in left wing ideas, but that's because I'm biased. You know, you and I can say this and you know reach a cozy consensus about it, but of course we would. But yeah. I think that's what I'm saying. I think it would be only fair to bring a dedicated lefty in and say, well, you know, justify yourself, prove your stance.
I know we've talked before about how the danger of echo chambers. I mean, I think only the right really understands the dangers of echo chambers. The left don't care. Well, there's another polarization. Maybe I'm being too polarized.
You see this thing where the left are perfectly fine with hypocrisy again and again. Like they're perfectly fine with power. Like they talk about it as if power is the worst thing in the world, but then when it comes to wielding it over us, they do so smugly and with glee.
Yeah, and with little thought. What I was going to say was that the day after seeing this play, I did have the opportunity to talk to a quite strong leftist who I think voted to Remain, who was a friend of my mum's. We were sitting down to a meal talking about this. And my parents had already mentioned that we went to see this play the night before and that I had hated it. And you know, I just brought it up in conversation. Oh, we went to see this play. And that they already knew that, oh, yes, you went to see that, and apparently you didn't like it very much, sort of thing. We went on to discuss some of the politics behind it. Where this leftist sort of started from, he said, well, of course, you know, equality is this lovely idea. Of course, communists just took it too far. And I sort of stopped and said, no, equality is not a lovely idea. It's not a lovely idea. And he said, oh, no, equality under the law is a lovely idea. And I said, yeah, well, we're not talking about equality under the law.
There was always equality under the law.
We've had that since like the 1300s.
Yeah.
This isn't about equality under the law. You don't need communism for that. This is about equality of outcome. And then he sort of quickly went into, oh, well, but some people are, you know, born with outcomes up here and others down here. Then he moves on to something else very quickly. But, you know, the way it is in, you know, social situations, I didn't want to sort of hammer down the point because it gets rude. But I think there was some sort of concession made. You know, I saw he had to sort of wriggle out of it and go somewhere else. And this, you know, is an intelligent guy. I think he may have been he certainly has a history degree.
Okay.
You know, this guy. I mean, he's I could listen to him talk about a lot of things.
I know. I'm not. I'm just thinking it's a funny thing. Well, he's an intelligent. Well, he does have a history degree.
He is a smart guy. But things. It's a bit like for me. At some point, the penny dropped that equality is a terrible thing to enforce, and I hadn't actually considered that before. That opinion had never been brought home to me. I think it's similar with this guy. Although he's considerably older. I mean, he's probably at least in his 60s. So this is a friend of my mum's, you see. So the older people get, it's hard, the harder it is to have new realizations like that. For me, that was a new realization, and it does change how you think about things. It's probably a physical change even. The way you start putting the world together.
I completely agree, and I would go so far as to say, and this probably will get clipped and used by my enemies, but I'm going to say it. I would go so far as to say that I view equality as my enemy. Because it's just an innately unrealistic, unhealthy, impractical, and dangerous and poisonous notion, that concept of moral, cultural, whatever equality is. It's completely unworkable, and the pursuit of it is extremely destructive.
Yes, and of course I'm going to agree, but as you pointed out, you know, your enemies will use that clip against you and say, well, if you're okay with lack of equality, then it's okay for your voice to be taken away by people with power, because you're okay with that, because you're in favor of inequality. But that's what they said. That's what the likes of Hope Not Hate will say. You know, that they would use that to justify persecuting you and saying, we've got the power.
Then they have to go against their own principles, their own professed belief in equality, don't they?
Implying they care. They don't care. They don't care about being hypocrites. These are not good people. And no, that's where I ended up. It's what I ended up realizing is that the myth of equality is used by evil people to gain power over good people.
And just one other thing before we go into that, I would just want to say that I think that not believing in equality does not mean that you don't believe in freedom of speech. I do believe in freedom of speech. Broadly speaking, for most people, that certainly the natives of a country, I think that they should have freedom of speech. I think that I don't necessarily believe that immigrants should have freedom of speech because it's not their home. They're guests. In the same way that someone who, your lodger, doesn't have free reign over the house like you do, because it's not his bloody house. So, but I think that, of course, that relies on the notion of ancestral ownership of a land. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is, I do believe in freedom of speech. So, no, I think that it would be dishonest for Hope Not Hate or anyone else to use this against me. I don't believe in equality because it's bullshit. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think Hope Not Hate are a dishonest organization. Almost everything they do is a lie. Almost everything.
Yeah.
What can you say? It's terrible. We have to share a world with these people, but we do. And this takes us back to the problem of libertarianism. Is that if good people don't seek power, then evil people will, and they'll use it against the good people, and that this is why a proper right-wing movement would have no shame about seeking power. I think we see this with the likes of the conservative movement, that they even with Boris, he's sort of portrayed as some sort of appalling right-wing fascistic figure, but he's constantly apologizing and like, oh God, I don't obsess anybody. Oh, dear me. You know, it's a caricature of the sort of like English self-depreciation. Although I don't think he's really like that. He's just very good at acting like that. And it is endearing. I find it endearing anyway. I think it's probably endearing to the English because we all feel a bit like that, you know. Well, maybe not all of us, but I do at times.
It definitely works with Sargon. I know that he really, not idolizes, but adores Boris and sees him as this sort of adorable buffoon.
Yeah, I can see that. I like Boris. I would urge him to become who he could be.
Become who you are.
Yeah, I'm not really sure who Boris is. I mean, when he got elected to be Conquer, leader of...
Expand, explore.
Well, yeah, why not? I mean, he certainly got some of that in him. You know, there's something in his character which he is, that they say, you know, this winner. I watched several programs about him when he became Conservative leader because I thought, well, I need to get a sense of who this guy is because I'm not really sure. There were two important things I watched. One was the program... I think it's called Who Are You, where they sort of look into people's... Was that what it's called? Anyway, it was something on YouTube.
Who do you think you are?
It might have been that. But basically, they had a lot of people that were close to him talking about him. And one was his sister, who's quite cute, actually, even though she's an older lady. But she was quite cheeky about Boris. And he said... she was asked by a man... what did she say? Hang on. She said something like, Boris doesn't want to be prime minister. He's much more ambitious than that. Basically, you know, being prime minister is not enough. So I mean, could he become some sort of neo-emperor of a reinstated British empire? I think given enough time, maybe. But he's always going to be hampered by his party, you know. But I mean, talking very broadly, very hypothetically, this is not really connected to anything real. I was, you know, quite excited and enlivened by the election result. I mean, as I said at the time, I much prefer if the Brexit Party had got some MPs because I think that the Conservatives need to have a threat from the right, or they're just going to sort of drift towards whatever Labour are doing.
Let's go into that. Let's finish the 2010s thing first, and then we can rush on to the recent election, because I know you've got a lot of thoughts, and that was one of the things I wanted to have you on to talk about. So any other thoughts about this decade that we're about to end, that we're leaving?
Yeah. Well, I think I was talking about the politicization of people through social media and the sort of polarization of the argument, which I do think broadly is left and right, although there is also the nationalist versus globalist thing. It's almost like the nationalist right versus the globalist left, kind of. And that's an interesting development, actually, that and I've heard other commentators talk about that capitalism has taken over the left. It's not that the left took over capitalism, but that capitalism has taken its what should have been its arch nemesis and absorbed it into itself and turned it into something it never used to be. So now we there is the phenomenon of woke capitalism, which is pushing radical egalitarian, anti-white, anti-male, sort of anti-family, anti-traditional values onto a population through its marketing, through its censorship. And we have these radical, formerly sort of radical leftist Marxist SJWs. Now they have the levers of power when it comes to who can speak and who can't speak, which is a tremendous power to have in a democracy where what can be said and understood is going to affect how people vote and even live. So capitalism has taken over the left, and I wonder, and this is going to go into like predictions for the future rather than just talk about this decade, but I think it's relevant now. I think that since 2016 there has been recognition that the dissident right is itself a kind of political force, and they've tried to neutralize us like utterly through censorship, and that sort of works to a degree. But I think there's other things that they're going to do, and I think they've even started doing it, and that's to treat the dissident right, or what you might call the dissident whites even, as a yet another competing group within the multicultural market, which needs to be catered to. So we will get, sort of fake politicians that for us to be distracted by, but they will also market entertainment to us as a way of sort of cathartically placating the anxieties of this movement, or the wishes and dreams as well. And obviously, I think that's what happened with this film, The Joker, which seemed to be explicitly marketed to a sort of dissident right kind of audience. But also something I've been watching lately, and I've been enjoying it a lot, actually, is this new Star Wars series called The Mandalorian, which very much appeals to sort of male archetypes. And as in sort of like, I don't want to talk about, so it's not exactly like to healthy male archetypes. So the main character is he's like a gunslinger. He sort of walks the world alone. It's a kind of multicultural world full of different alien races. It's, very Star Wars. He's outside of the normal authority structures, but he's extremely competent and capable. And he also takes care of, he has a heart. He takes care of this sort of baby Yoda thing that everybody loves. You're not a Star Wars fan, are you? You're sort of born a bit too late for it.
I wasn't born a bit too late because I grew up during the 80s and loads of my friends were into it, but somehow and it wasn't that I was trying to be different. It just somehow didn't enter my life. I have no idea why.
Right. So I can feel as I'm talking about this Star Wars series, it's not really resonating with you. I'd recommend watching it.
Don't feel like, because I am following what you're saying. So just keep going. I mean, I've seen the original trilogy. I haven't seen the prequel trilogy. I've seen bits of it, and then I've seen the Force Awakens, which was another new trilogy.
Well, I mean, I was listening to your chat with how do you pronounce her name? Is it Philosocat?
No, it's Philosophicat.
Philosophicat. Yeah. Not philosophy cat. Philosophicat.
Yeah, philosophy.
Do you know what? Something I learned this year was, philo means someone that loves. And Sophia is an ancient name for wisdom. So a philosopher is a lover of wisdom. I didn't know that until this year.
I think I'd heard that, but I didn't know.
I think it's quite beautiful. She talked in your chat with her, which I gather ruffled some people's feathers a little bit. But I was fine with like everything she said, I thought, anyway. She talked a lot about sort of male archetypes and female archetypes and sort of healthy masculine values and that, you know, their corresponding counterparts and all that. And I see, as she was talking about, I was thinking about this drama which I've been watching, the Mandalorian, and seeing how they've put sort of healthy male archetypes in that. And I think in a way that they want people that isn't right to identify with this figure and sort of live his life sort of cathartically, and so that they can feel like the hero that he's very much like the sort of the gunslinger in a Western that turns up in a town that's got a problem and then sort of helps them solve their problem. And then he goes on his way as if the
renegade, the loner.
But he's got a good heart and he helps people and he does the right thing. I think there's something really appealing about that, and I can see how that
very much
I can see how, and I think that is probably marketed to a dissident right audience. And another thing I think which has been marketed to this right is this recent Dark Crystal. I won't talk about that too much, but I think that there's stuff in there which makes you think this was kind of aimed not solely at us, but just so that we can enjoy it. Because one of the main ways that global homo placates a population is by turning them into consumers, and that means sort of bringing them into the fold and marketing to them and creating the bread and circuses for them for us. And what leaves me with that is like, well, how do I feel about that? How do I feel about that? This movement that I'm part of, which is very much dissidents, we've been sort of, they're trying to sort of osmotically sort of draw us into this never ending mess of sort of fighting groups and everything. Yeah.
This links, I don't know if this linked directly from what you're saying about the left feel that the capitalism has co-opted them, and you're saying that the very same thing could happen to the dissident right.
I don't know if the left feel that way, but that's definitely what's happened. They basically are handed power by capitalists, and they don't notice the contradiction, as they never do. They never notice their own hypocrisy. And I'm just wondering, I mean, I think it's already happening, that as a way to control and contain the dissident right, obviously they've done all this censorship, take away our ability to speak for ourselves, but then create mythological stories which speak for us and speak to us, so that people, that we can just become, ordinary consumers again, like we're meant to be, and not care about this fantastical sort of legendary struggle that we're engaged in as sort of,
I mean, it's the cliche of how capitalism takes something and makes it anodyne, empty and meaningless, but more fun, but more accessible and consumable. I don't know. I think you might be right that's possible. I don't know whether it's happening now, because I haven't seen The Mandalorian, but I think you might be right that could happen, that they might just start seeing us, that they might convert us into another customer base.
Yeah, I think that's almost inevitable, because that's what it does, isn't it? And that's how it brings people into the fold, by giving them what they want, even if it's not what they really want. It might be a simulation of what they want.
Well, they're, it's like in the late 90s when people would say that certain musicians are just, they're not, like, there's a guy in the chat, right, actually, Woz is this agent trying to pacify the dissident right with new forms of entertainment. I am trying to please people within this entertainment that is millennial, but I'm not trying to pacify them, like drug them up or something. So sorry, Mitos, you're barking up the wrong tree there. I am not a Mossad agent or MI5 or whatever.
Well, the thing is, what you're doing is authentic, and you're speaking, as much as you can from what you really feel, Whereas this stuff which is coming largely from Netflix, which we know is sort of a Soros-owned operation, these things are scripted and targeted, at us. I think, you know, I mean, it could be, you know, just to make an argument against what I've just said, that the things which appeal to us are these sort of eternal archetypes, these eternal heroic archetypes, and they've gone back to writing those into the scripts. Because, you know, that's how you make good stories. And in that way, they resonate with us. But I do think there's been enough sort of like little hints and
Before you go on, just let me finish that point I was making before that guy interrupted me. Basically, people would say, this is, like in the late 90s, people would say, this isn't real goth or this isn't real punk. This is commercialized punk, which is ironic because, of course, punk was always envisioned by Malcolm McLaren as a, look into his early life as a commercial thing in the first place. But anyway, people say this has had the soul filleted out of it. It's something meaningless. I don't know if the same thing. I mean, I can see where you're going, that maybe anything at all can be commercialized and made meaningless. But I'm wondering if that could even happen with the dissident right. I do think they'll try.
It would make sense to look, if I was in their kind of position, that's what I would do, right? And I'm sure you would as well. That would be the smart thing to do. And the whole notion of bread and circuses, right? That goes back thousands of years. It's like, you know, should you lower the taxes or give them, you know, free bread and circuses? I can't remember the exact scenario, but the idea is already there amongst, you know, the ruling classes, is that you just need to placate people with nonsense and then they're not really a political problem anymore. And I think that is happening. I think we're going to see more of that happening. Now, will it work though? And how do I feel about it? Well, I think so long as people can point out that that's what they're doing, it's not going to work.
To be honest, here's just something to throw a spanner in the works. Maybe you could say that the alt-light was an attempt to do this.
I'm not sure about the alt-light. I think, if we talk about things that happened this decade, I was kind of sympathetic to the alt-light. I think the division that happened, as well as the alt-right, of course, the division that happened between the alt-light and the alt-right ended up being worse for the alt-right than the alt-light. They were at least able to continue going. Also, I mean, this is something I did want to talk about, that there was a time when, you know, before that split, where everybody was working sort of organically in concert. So some event would happen and Paul Joseph Watts would make a video about it, and Lauren Southern would make a video about it, and Stefan Molyneux would make a video about it, and Sargonov Akkad would make a video about it. Everyone would have their own certain take. You'd make a video about it. Black Pigeon Speaks. You know, everyone would have their sort of take about this thing. And this had a kind of amplifying effect that we were creating together and organically as well. That made it even more authentic. A counter-narrative to what was going on in the mainstream. And that had to be destroyed. From the perspective of the mainstream, that had to be destroyed because that there's a potential to gain far too much power doing that, with building up a continuous counter narrative to whatever crap they're putting out. You see, because they're putting the mainstream media, as I'm sure everyone listening understands, is basically a propaganda machine, and they're putting out a repetitive, continuous message which reinforces a certain worldview all the time. They're doing that all the time. And what we saw with the emergence of the outright, you know, prior to the split, was an organic response to that, which was actually more powerful and resonated with people more. To the extent that they were actually happy to hand over their money to pay people to do this. And then, since 2016, when I think it really sort of got through to the people in charge that there was this dangerous phenomena emerging, that that's when they did things like the alternative influencer reports. I think they probably looked at the various networks of connection. Well, we know they did that. They looked at the various connections between people, between different content creators and what people were watching, how people were moving from certain content creators to others. And they decided to start cutting, you know, burning all the bridges such that, there was no movement left anymore. And you know, the really sad thing is they've kind of been successful in doing that since 2015.
Here's what I would say about this. I don't think they needed to be successful. I've said before, I think there could be a collective effort against this, but it would require, obviously, the participation of the alt-right. And I think they are the reason that there is, I mean, they've killed themselves, they've completely neutered themselves, they've left the alt-right stranded to a great extent. But that has not killed the alt-right. I mean, other things killed the alt-right. I would say personalities, the general nature of the... I mean, I've written a script for a video about this, which I might put up in the new year. I'm not sure, because it will piss a lot of people off. But I think there are some home truths that could be told about the alt-right. And not against just the reasons for its current state. But I think that really what destroyed this thing, that this interplay between those two movements, as it were, was that the alt-right simply lost all moral courage. At this point, I don't know what the difference, I mean, to the extent that you can even say the alt-right still exists, it does, because the people involved are still there, like Milo, PJW, etc. But I don't know what the difference is between them and the mainstream right. I don't know what does Paul Joseph Watson stand for that Boris Johnson doesn't stand for, or some average Tory politician doesn't stand for. I can't think of anything.
Yeah, I suppose.
So it's a fucking waste of space. I mean, it's just nonsense. It's counterculture. Now, I'm saying that. I hate saying that, because I want to like the guy, believe that he's useful. But right now, I haven't seen anything for the last year or 2 years that is anything useful coming from him. Or who else you could say in the alt-light? I mean, Mike Cernovich? I don't even know what he's doing. Milo seems to have devolved entirely into just bitching about people and attacking other people in the movement. So he's utterly pointless at this stage and positively venomous. So, I mean, what's the point of them? And I don't say that. I want them to be there. I want them to be useful. But they're just not. They're just not being useful. As I say, I don't know what the point of them is at this stage. But the main thing here is, I think they lost all moral courage, that whatever of it they did have in the first place in 2015, 2016. And at this point, they are completely conformist. They got scared by the censorship to such an extent that they don't want to risk anything at all. And so that they distance themselves from us in a massive way. And as a result, they are now that they have no oomph. They have no point to them anymore.
That's rather sad. I'm not sure what to say.
I mean, look, someone just said PJW is afraid of losing his channel. Of course he is. We all are.
Thing is, about that, I remember not that long ago Paul Joseph Watson announcing that he was leaving YouTube, that he was so disgusted by something, censorship or something, and he left YouTube. But then he came back.
Well, to be fair, I also made a similar announcement in August during one of the purges, because I just assumed that's it. It's over now. As it happened, a lot of those channels were reinstated, and it has rolled on a bit longer. As for him, that's the thing. That's the thing I really find disappointing about him in particular, is that he has the stature, the following, that if he decided to just go on to BitChute, or to go into Gab even, that would inject a lot of life into those websites. And but he doesn't. He doesn't do anything like that. So,
well, yeah. I don't know. I'm not keen on... I'm not really keen, as you aren't either, I'm not keen on infighting. I think definitely we waste energy. Not. I think definitely we waste energy that way. And I think, you know, our mutual enemies... they're delighted when we're in fighting, because we're doing their job for them, you know.
But they're also delighted when we're disavowing each other, which is what.
Oh yes, that too. I mean, I think a big problem with that happened in 2016, that the start of the crack between alt light and alt right was when, and I particularly remember this, Paul Joseph Watson was disavowing Richard Spencer's Hail Trump speech, claiming that there'd been all, a mass amount of, people doing, Roman salutes and things, when that just hadn't happened. One or two people at most, and it transpired that at least one of those persons was a joker, of a different, agenda. And one of them was just really drunk and just having a laugh. And the whole point of it was just people were just being daft. A big part of the whole kind of, ironic Nazi LARP, which went on in the alt-right, was that it largely libertarian or just sort of right-leaning people that were just so fed up of being called Nazis for the slightest transgression from left-wing progressive thought, that they just decided to sort of own the term as a kind of... Like, okay, we don't even care if you call us Nazis anymore. We're sick of it. We're not, but in most cases, they weren't actually Nazis. It was just a kind of a fuck you to the very fake morality of the progressive left, who, as we've discussed, are total hypocrites. So why should we play by their rules? And the big mistake that Paul Joseph Watson, and I remember he did a stream with Cernovich when they were disavowing, the term outright, which previously they'd embraced, so hard. That was very disappointing. Zero out of 10 for that, Paul Joseph Watson. But things you've talked about, you don't think that. What would you like Paul Joseph Watson to talk about?
Well, just now, I've been fairly negative about him. And then I remember, I calmed down and I remember, well, hold on, nobody wants to lose everything that they've built up. So, maybe I should be more. I mean, there are things that I don't talk about because I don't want to lose everything I've built up. And it's a certain pragmatism, which, yeah, okay, it's human. What I resent about him is not so much that he doesn't talk about certain things, it's that he actively countersignals the people who do. And I think that is just not necessary. I don't think it helps him. And even if it did, I think it would be dishonorable. And it definitely doesn't help the movement as a whole. So it only delights our enemies. So why do it? It's just, it's silly. Just stop counter-signaling.
Yeah, the whole punching right thing, it's like people in the alt-right proper understood why that's a failed strategy. And I think, a lot of people got the memo about that. But some people didn't. Somehow that information didn't get through to them. And I think Paul Joseph Watson was one of those people. So he went on eagerly punching right, thinking that was going to do him some good. Well, maybe it has done him some good. He's still got his platform. But in terms of...
He's still got YouTube. He hasn't got Facebook, Instagram.
Right.
He's still got Twitter as well.
And, maybe part of the problem is that not enough people had got the message about that, about the failures of punching right. I mean, I got it. Lots of other people got it. I can't remember where I got it from. I also the understanding about salami tactics, how the left used this strategy to constantly accuse the people on the most viable part of the right of being fascist and Nazi and everything until everyone else disavows. And then that section is effectively destroyed because no one else wants anything to do with them. And once that's gone, they accuse the next most viable part of the right as being fascist, Nazi.
Oh, yeah.
They just keep doing that until basically there are no opinions left except their own.
Yes. Hold on a minute. I'm going to read out a bit from this script that I wrote because it was about this culture of disavowing and it's relevant to this. I remember thinking our enemies must laugh at us. They must laugh their heads off as they watch us disavow and sabotage each other, whether to satiate our own egos or to grovel for their approval, their mercy, their appeasement, which of course they will never give. No, as each of us disavows, our enemies will use his treachery to sow new seeds of paranoia among those of us who remain. From our present weakness, they will conjure our future weakness. And for helping them to do so, we will blame not ourselves, but each other. Our enemies win because we lack solidarity.
Yes, and of course the left have very much solidarity with their own... Well, I don't you know, that their most potent activists, and I'm always reminded. I mean, people in the UK have been talking a lot about Ash Sarkar recently, and Owen Jones, and also this group called Novara Media. And I have a particular kind of bugbear about those guys because, as I'm sure lots of people do, but they, I mean, they're obviously extreme left. They're advocating very, very far left ideas. So it's like, you know, what is it? Aaron Bastani is his notion of a fully automated luxury communism, which is sort of, you know, it's this sort of this new version of the left, this sort of like sort of gay, trans, automated communism stuff, just that everything from the intersectional left sort of rolled into one package plus technology. And those guys, I mean, I remember watching them before Ash Sarkar sort of broke through into the mainstream. And she broke through into the mainstream because she was a part of the anti-Trump protest with that ridiculous balloon, that baby balloon. And she was invited onto a daytime talk show. It was a morning talk show with Piers Morgan, where Piers Morgan is a sort of pro-Trump guy. Piers Morgan's argument was sort of like, oh, well, if you're going to complain these things about Trump, why didn't you complain about Obama? Because he's done all the same things. And it was something to do with the border control or something like that. And her response, because she was so far left, she was like, well, you know, I didn't care about Obama either because I'm literally a communist, you idiot. That was her way of neutering Piers Morgan's argument. It was like, well, I'm so far left, I don't even care. You know, I would have done this about Obama too, but I was just too young. You know, I'm just doing it about Trump. And that sort of catapulted her to stardom. You know, to the point where, you know, she's been on Question Time, which is of course the flagship political discussion program. And even on the night of the recent election results, she was sitting there on a sofa with Owen Jones talking about the results.
What a pair of wallies. I mean, why? It really just speaks volumes that two fucking airheads like that are on national TV for an election.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the mainstream left, they embrace their radical elements and give them a platform because they know it helps them. It makes them seem more moderate, but it also...
It edges the Overton window.
Because there'll be people that sort of partially agree with these. They're basically gaming everyone to think in a more left-wing way by bringing these extreme left ideas in. And what annoyed me about particularly about Novara Media is that I remember being aware of their stuff before they broke through, and just thinking what a bunch of clowns they were. And at that time, I had a YouTube channel, which of course has been deleted now. And my YouTube channel actually had more subscribers than theirs did. And I was thinking, well, how come these? I mean, and they were a collective as well. They weren't one guy. They were a collective, a set of several voices on the left. You know, Aaron Bastani himself, Ash Sarkar, some nutcase called Sean Fay, who's a sort of like a... Oh, he's like the gayest person you can imagine, but he also dresses up as a woman, and he has some sort of monument to sort of... to channel gay energy into him behind himself in video. I don't know if he's still making it, but he's a complete, you know, like queer intersectional theorist lunatic. You know, these guys who ought to be irrelevant. It's like they went straight from Tumblr, like theorizing on Tumblr in the mad echo chamber that used to exist there, and just went onto YouTube and just sort of dumped all that crap there. When nobody on YouTube really likes that stuff or likes. I mean, things may be different now. And then they just got scooped up from there and sort of put onto the mainstream, where they're talking to people like my mum. It's like
a communist cult.
Yeah, and things that the opposite way around would never happen. I don't even know if there is a right wing political discussion program like on the mainstream TV in the UK at all. But if there were, they wouldn't be sort of scooping up some dissident right YouTuber like you, for example, or Morgoth or Laura Tower, and said, you know, and during an election, say, oh, let's see what Melania Woese thinks about this this election result. Now, it just wouldn't happen. It occurs to me just as I was saying that, and this hadn't occurred to me before. You could say, this used to be something that the outright lamented, that the left embraced their radical elements, but the right is always constantly disavowing. But as we saw in this recent UK election, the fact that the left has embraced these radical elements didn't really work for them well in this election, this recent election. And maybe that's, I don't know. It's a left minute.
Well, you see, you made a very good point on the, I think it was on the pre-election stream with that Mark did, where you said that, maybe it was on the, no, it must have been, it was more likely on the after-election stream that you did, where you said, and I've repeated this point on Millennial several times already, because it was such a good point, you said that the left actually disabled themselves or hampered themselves by censoring us from social media, because it meant that they lost touch with what a lot of people were thinking. And I think you might have also said that it meant that they no longer had to. They had free rein. They could just go nuts. And they did. And part of it is that they have cleaned us out of all the spaces that they occupy, so that they only experience constant reaffirmation and amplification of their own views.
Yeah. And I mean, that finally, maybe they got their comeuppance this election, but I think as you pointed out subsequently, will they have learned anything from that? I actually think, as you think, that they probably won't, because to sort of actually stop while all the rest of them are sort of moving ever leftward, to stop still and say, you know what, maybe those guys over there, maybe those racist fascists and Nazis were actually right about something, would be to say, well, then that whichever individual dares to say that is then a Nazi sympathizer and is themselves, you know, as bad as a racist fascist and a Nazi. It's like they can't ever stop and say, hey, maybe the racists are right. How can any of them ever do that? So that they can only ever keep going one direction.
Yeah.
But these guys still, as I said, they've still got the levers of power in YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. So what are they going to do? I mean, it's easy for us. We're in the UK, so this election is really important to us. Obviously these companies are multinational, so it's not that the UK election may be just a drop in the ocean. Perhaps the ramifications of it haven't got through to everybody else yet.
A lot of Americans are seeing this as a harbinger, or what would the word? There's a word for that, but an indication of how their election is going to go next year,
like a sort of precursor, sometimes you get a little tremor before a big earthquake,
yeah,
something like that,
yeah, like the Brexit referendum was,
yeah, a bit like that. You see, because these guys have still got, you know, the levers of power, at least on social media, I think they'll go nuts with the censorship. Should Trump win, they'll go absolutely nuts. I think they probably will in the UK anyway. I mean, we're not great. We're terrible on the whole free speech front as it is. I don't know if Boris is aware enough to sort of try and address that. I mean, he's going to have so much to deal with in terms of like the left-wing infestation of all our institutions and all the rest of it. And it does seem this guy, Dominic Cummings, I don't know a lot about him, but he's a close advisor to Boris. And he seems to be, from things I've read, seems to be aware of this sort of, you know, what we call the long march of the institutions. He is interested in breaking up some of the, you know, our version of the deep state, which probably just amounts to, well, some elements, maybe not the deep state in terms of like we think of it, really sinister spy organizations and things, but in terms of all these ridiculous quangos and think tanks set up by Blair, which sort of sit around in, you know, in Whitehall somewhere, just coming up with terrible ideas. I think he's interested in dismantling some of those. But as for this, sort of, the whole sort of social media aspects, I don't know how much of this gets through to people like Tories. I don't know how much they know about things like Antifa either. I don't know how, and this is something, you know, that I think is really important for, you know, the dissident right going forward, is that we can't just be these guys on the internet, you know, talking amongst ourselves in like ever diminishing circles of, you know, fearful of censorship and everything. The things we talk about have to get through to people in political parties and people that may eventually gain some sort of power, even if it's small amounts of power, even if it's a council seat, even, you know, whatever it is. It's there has to be a way of channeling the stuff we talk about through to places where it actually matters. And I think that that's very doable. I mean, I was talking to you about earlier, I got involved with the Brexit Party, earlier this year, and sort of try to help out with this recent election. I think lots of people can do things like that. And I'd say, and it's good for you to get off the internet. I'm not saying leave the internet behind entirely. I think this will always be a really viable place for us to discuss things. But it's nice to get around people who think more the way you do. And because a lot of people, they say, I'm surrounded by lefties at my job, I'm surrounded by lefties at college, etc. Well, if you join a nascent even if it's just civic nationalist kind of political party, you'll find a lot of people that have a lot of things you can talk to them about, common points of agreement. And I think, just go back to this whole outright split thing. We're more powerful if we focus on where we agree.
That's what people do in the corporate world, in the real world. They focus on, well, what can we actually get done together? Any two people. That's the normal, well-adjusted way to go about things. It's also how the left, who are much more socially intelligent than the right, it's also how they do things. They say, well, what do we agree on? We agree that equality is the goal, right? So our disagreements don't really matter, because if we perceive this common goal, we'll beat the right. And they do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting you said the left are more socially intelligent, because I generally don't think of the left of being that intelligent at all. And so I was talking earlier on about how I used to be around a lot of left-wing people, and this is going to sound a bit arrogant, but I basically realized I was more intelligent than all of them.
Yeah,
but when I went from their spaces to when I first sort of entered kind of, as they were called then, like outright discussion areas, it was for the first time in kind of years, I realized I was talking to people who were more intelligent than I am and who were thinking about things which I hadn't even considered. So the difference in intelligence, you actually said socially intelligent when it comes to the left.
Yes. I just see this, because how else have they managed to do what they've done over the last 70 years? I think that they understand momentum. I think they understand diplomacy. For example, in 1967, they decriminalized homosexual sex between consenting adults behind closed doors. They didn't advocate for drag queen story hour. They understood this is how people operate. You have to go one step at a time. I think they are just not leftists, not the people we meet in daily life, but the people who have spearheaded the left over the last 70 years. Yeah, I think they are. There's a lot of social intelligence there.
Yeah. I see your point. And I think one of the left's biggest powers is actually conformity.
Yes.
That they will naturally lockstep on issues. It's like you talk about social intelligence versus, I don't know, what is the old, the other kind of intelligence, more sort of abstract thinking?
Autism,
yeah. It's like the left have sort of like female social intelligence, whereas the right has sort of autistic abstract intelligence. I mean, certainly the dissident right. And so we do get very het up about people being, wrong about some issue or tactic or thing, and get into these big arguments. While the left is just sort of moves more like a sort of slime mold. It has a sort of...
Yeah.
But I mean, this is something that needs to be remedied.
Yeah. So someone else has made the point. The dissident right has a lot of damaged people, in my opinion, himself included, the writer. I think that might also be a problem, because I perceive this, I've seen it for the last 5 or 6 years, that there are a lot of damaged people who arrive at these ideas for various reasons. And by the way, I don't want to push this too far, because of course it will be used as evidence that, well, you believe these things because you're damaged. That's not what I mean. I simply mean that it takes people who are a bit burnt out, a bit pissed off, a bit angry, a bit dejected, to understand how bad the situation actually is.
Well, I think society is actually damaging white people at the moment anyway. Yes, so of course we're going to get some damaged people.
Oh, but yeah.
Honestly, there's a lot of damaged people on the left.
Yeah,
I can. You know, I've been around the sort of grassroots left, and I wouldn't say any of them are well-adjusted people, honestly. All kinds of problems.
Yeah, I can believe that. Maybe I shouldn't focus too much on this aspect of the right, because
I think focusing on better mental health is a good is a sort of winning strategy, actually.
Definitely, and that's what I want to do next year. It's one of the things I want to do next year is set a good example. You know, work out what are the things that I do wrong and in my thinking processes and so on. So, and thus help other people. But I think at this point we're going to have to end it because my next guest is due on in 7 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. We could talk for ages. Do you want to wrap up your thoughts about this decade and this election? I'm sorry.
Maybe
go for another 15 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's been a decade of polarization. I think there has been, you know, and social media has played its role in that. But I do think there is some sort of, some sort of shift in awareness has happened. People have become politicized that never used to be before. I very much doubt if that's going to go away. Whatever happens next decade is probably going to be even more exciting. I'm actually quite excited about this next decade, but I think we're going to end up being vindicated about a lot of things that we
I think
about.
So too. I'm not black-pilled. I'm very optimistic about, I mean, I think that we will set up on other websites, for example. So the social media side of it, I think, will be, and not just the social, what I mean is the online side of it. The fact, because this has been a very online phenomenon, and I don't think that's going to die. I think it will simply set up home on other websites. And hopefully from there we can operate safely as a sort of power base. So I'm not worried about that. And as for in the public in general, I think our ideas are permeating all the time. Don't worry about super chats. We're going to do the super chats, everyone. Don't worry about that. Any final thoughts?
I'll wrap it up there because we are running out of time. But thanks for having me on. And
we'll do the super chats now.
I want to wish everyone. Oh, I'm not going yet. All right. Okay.
We've got to do the super chats because I promised that. Okay, so Zurius, what are your top three, your favorite Zurius tracks?
My favorite track that I've written is Fight for Western Civilization. I think that's on my second album. I like Death to Traitors, and I also like Wheatfields.
Okay. All right. And also, can you do a pop-up illegal rave outside YouTube headquarters?
Sorry, I'm going to have to say no on that. Sorry.
Okay. I'm curious, what tips do you have for someone who wants to get into electronic music production in 2020? What are the best DAWs what does DAW stand for again? I've forgotten.
Digital Audio Workstation. It means music studio software.
Right, and VSTs, which is virtual synths, and hardware and gear, etc.
I don't know what the best ones are. It's a matter of debate. But I use Reason. That's the one I like the most. Although I don't have a lot of experience with the other ones, but Reason is the one that I really have got to grips with. Advice of getting into it. It's much easier to get into if you have some prior musical training, I think. I've been involved with music since I was very young, so I've always had musical training. So I just had to learn the software. I actually learned on hardware, and then I had to translate that onto the software. So I think it's much easier if you have some existing musical skill. If you don't have that, I think it's going to be much harder, and you'll probably be unhappy with the music you make. Probably, but I've not come in from that. So, you know, I always had that. I had some musical training already. So I'm sometimes reticent about encouraging people to get into music production because it can be a real downer when things aren't working well. So I wouldn't wish that on anybody. So it's like, if you're really up for the, if you're up for it, do it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount that could be said about electronic music production. I'm not musical. I don't have any skill in that regard, any talent, but I do love synthesizers. And I've got some at the back there. I like hardware. Zures is much more into software. So that's a perpetual disagreement and cause of consternation between us. But I do use FL Studio. Yeah, that's I love the stuff on the that ends up on the channel is made in FL Studio. but that's a huge topic. Someone did ask, do you use Serum?
Serum is a virtual synth. I don't actually. I've watched some tutorials on it though. The thing is, for reason, the DAW I use, the workstation I use, doesn't, or at least until recently, didn't accept VSTs made by other companies. They've actually updated the software, actually, I think a couple of years ago now, that it does, but I still haven't used any of the other VSTs, which I ought to be honest. I ought to, but there's so much I can do with the stuff that's in Reason already, and there's so much in there that I haven't even learned it all yet. So I haven't actually used the synth I use the most currently is Thor. That's my favorite. So that's my go-to synth. But Reason has other great synths in it, such as Europa and this. Such as Europa, which is something I intend to learn, but I haven't actually learned it yet.
Right. I've just been messaged by Semi Ogog. He's happy to delay for a while because he's enjoying listening to our chat. So there isn't so much of a time problem. We can go for another 10 or 20 minutes. We'll just keep going with these. I said hardware is the best, or that I like hardware. Someone said analog for the win. Yeah, sure. Real analog does have its a certain charm, but also just hardware. I mean, even if it's like my main one, the yellow, you can't see it here, sorry, but my main synth just now is digital. It's completely digital, but it sounds lovely. And I just love the hardware, the fact that you can actually turn real knobs and switches and so on. I really enjoy that. If Millennial goes well, I would like to buy a new synth in January, one that Zures and I have discussed, actually. But we'll see. We'll see how well Millennial goes. And if so, obviously, I'll make some video about that, maybe for the one of the minor channels, not for the main one. But yeah, it's hardware is just a real pleasure. I love that feeling. The K2, someone mentioned the Behringer K2, which is an update of or clone of the Korg MS-20. It's cool, but the one that I want, the Hydrosynth, is much, much, much more useful. Much more flexible. It's amazing. So Buchla, that's a completely different paradigm that I'm not accustomed to at all. All right, so back to Zures, because this is your time. What are Zures' main musical influences, and from where does he take his name?
Oh, right. Well, I'll start with my name because that's easy. This might disappoint some people because it's not a great story. But Zures was actually just a typo which I made years ago. I meant to type Furious and I hit the X instead, and I really liked the way it looked on the screen. I didn't use that as an artist name. It was just that was a username that I was using on a site for some time, and then later. When I sort of joined the Dissident Right, I took that name and used it as an artist name. What was the other question?
What are your main musical influences?
You know, I'm constantly actually forgetting this, but I do know that there are certain synthwave artists that I go back to, and I have them in a playlist, so that I don't actually have to remember them. But I know that I really like Wave Shaper. That's one of the synthwave guys that I really like. That's the only name I can remember because I think it's such a cool name, Wave Shaper. As someone that's into synths and synthesis, I'm sure Wes could appreciate you. What you're essentially doing is shaping waveforms.
Yeah, there's a function called wave shaping, which is
oh, is there? Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that. I mean, I'm constantly finding out new things about synths. But all of synthesis is shaping of waves of what, and making music as well, is you're creating waveforms in the air. And anyway, he's one of my favorite synthwave artists.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a reference to the general act of synthesis or if it's a reference to the function that is specifically called wave shaping, which is a kind of distortion. It's quite cool. It sort of beefs up the sound. It doubles up the sound.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, move on to the next question. Always a massive fan of your work, Zurius. Have you ever considered producing styles of music other than synthwave? And if so, which ones?
I've produced lots of different styles of electronic music. I'm often thinking about things like that, actually. Sometimes I think it'd be nice to actually write something like a string quartet, because when I did my musical training, I did learn how to compose for different instruments, but I don't think this was a long time ago, I think about lots of different things that I could do, you know, sometimes.
Someone's pointing out that there is a wave shaper in Thor, so you should have a look at it.
Oh my God! So there's that, right, I have to look that up then and see what.
Okay, we can buy your old Amazon your old albums on Amazon Music. The money goes to you, or is it someone who stole the music?
Hopefully, that's going to me.
Well, hopefully,
I've seen. Yeah, I think it is.
Okay. This is a bit of an obvious question. What do you think about the Iowa man who received a 16-year prison sentence for stealing and burning a rainbow pride flag under hate crime laws?
Was that 16 years?
16 years. It's absolutely incredible.
It beggars belief, really, doesn't it?
16
years for stealing and burning a flag.
Well, that's insane, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
I'm so stunned by it, I can't even think of what to say about it. The first thing that comes to mind is that, you know, his crime is that's a political crime.
Mm-hmm.
No one's actually been hurt. That so he burnt a political symbol, you know, the symbol which has come to be the symbol of Globo Homo, and he burnt it, and he's been punished viciously for that. I almost can't believe it. 16 years, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's astonishing that it happened. I think yesterday or the day before.
Really? Well, hopefully Paul Joseph Watson will make a video about it.
Someone's saying he had a record and other charges, so maybe it isn't as simple as I've read. Okay, let's move on. Do you think the alt-right is in need of a new name? This has been a debate that's been going since, a long time. The word has been used so much, it kind of belongs to the pile of useless curse words that hold only negative feelings.
I think people are saying dissident right now. I think we've been talking about the outright because we've been talking about this decade that's gone. So we kind of had to talk about the what was. Dissident right seems to be a much more functional term for now.
I think so too. I agree. For a long time I wanted to sort of try to preserve that term alt-right, but then I thought, even I don't like what it's now associated with. I don't like the rallies. I'm sorry, because I know this will annoy some people, but I think it was bad. It's bad optics, bad tactics. And by that time it was associated with that. You know, when I first associated with the term alt-right, it meant something much more. And I go into this in that script I told you about earlier. When I first associated with it in late 2015, it meant something much more interesting and much bigger than just nationalism or white nationalism. It was something far more open-minded, and I liked it then. I was interested in it then. But I sort of kept loyal to it because I just am a loyal kind of guy. And I think that was kind of a mistake on my part. I think I should have let it die, because I think most people wanted it to just die. to just let it go. And I think it is something off the past now at this stage. I mean, it was something just for a moment in time, and I mean prior to the Trump mania thing in 2015, for a moment there, it was something very interesting that had a lot of potential, and then it became this populist Trumpian thing, which was fun but ultimately pretty boneheaded and not nearly enough. And then in 2017 it became the rallies, and it just became, partly through the mistakes of people on our own side and partly through the massive media demonization campaign, the term became something that simply meant, it was synonymous with evil and stupid and horrible. So, you know, after that, it was just basically useless. You know, and I don't like it because they could obviously do the same thing with any term at all. And so it's kind of like, well, why give up on that one? If they're going to do it with whichever new one you choose, you may as well just stick with the original. But I think not enough people, I just think it had been solid from outside, but also from within. And so it was something that, in the end, I was not glad to get rid to stop associating with the term, but I was kind of relieved to stop associating with it. Felt like letting go of a burden.
You want me to say something now? I agree. I mean, it's in a way, and I think this is something you said, it showed that the power the mainstream media still has in sculpting people's minds, is that they outright wasn't something, was something new. I can remember a point when Trump was sort of questioned about the outright, and he just said, nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what it is. Now, they're trying to use it to smear him, and it was just like, you're just talking about nonsense. So they made sure that everybody, you know, in quote marks, knows what it is, and it was this horrible evil thing. That's yes. What. So and they use that. They use their power to press that into people's minds, and then it became something which, you know, people didn't want to say, yeah, I'm part of the outright, because the first response you might get would be, oh my God, you're one of those evil people. Well, you know, and it's, yeah, it showed the power that the mainstream media, you know, had and still has to tell their stories about you, and people believe that and then not you. So it's, you know, it's an exercise in you know, the psychological power of the media. It's a sad state of affairs.
Yes, it did. Somebody says here, alt-right equals, hold on a second, it keeps disappearing. Bugger, it's gone away. There was a definition that somebody offered, and I was going to use it as an example. Ah, here we go. Traditionalistic geno-civilizational patriotism. That's one way to define it, but I would say even that is too limited. When you consider what it was in mid-2015, it was even more broad than that, because it wasn't necessarily traditionalistic. Traditionalist. It wasn't necessarily ethno-nationalist. It was much more, you know, there was the civilizational aspect to it as well, much broader than just nations. So there were all these questions that were going to be explored, but then it became much more simplistic, and those questions were not explored. And
you know, I'm just reminded how, you know, the far left... feminism for a time became a dirty word from the sort of 70s. It was like 70s feminism was this ridiculous, you know, bra burning and all that crazy stuff. And for the 80s and 90s, it's almost like it sort of went quiet. Of course, the feminists were still there, work away in academia. But what they did was they made up many different terms for themselves. So you got this one is a social feminist, and this one's a Marxist feminist, this one's a radical feminist. So they kind of, they atomized their movement into 1,000 different names. And then at a later date, they brought it all back together again. One of the effects of having all those different names for the various different movements and factions is that they would confuse opponents. You didn't know what type of feminist you were arguing with. And they would always pretend that made a big difference. It's like, oh, well, you know, she's a social feminist, whereas this one is an XY kind of feminist, and this is a different, you know, it's like, oh, you don't even know who you're arguing with. You don't understand anything. You're not educated. I mean, maybe we could do a similar thing. What was this term the guy came up with? It sounded suitably confusing. You're muted.
Sorry. Traditionalistic geno-civilizational patriotism.
Maybe I'll call a track that.
Okay. You can call it the radical feminist remix and the intersectional remix and so forth.
Yeah. I won't, you know, I'll keep feminism out of it. But,
yeah. Okay. All right, then. Well, on that pleasant note, let's call it a day, because this has been a very interesting conversation. I feel it could go on forever. I think we have broadly done a kind of good survey of the 2010s and all of this, our perspective on it, from, you know, talking about our concerns from this decade. So thank you very much. I hope you have you enjoyed this.
Yeah, it's been a great discussion. I was worried that I wasn't going to have anything to say, you know.
I wasn't worried that you weren't going to have anything to say. I knew this would go well.
All right.
I was confident about this one.
All right. No, thanks for having me on. And I want to wish everyone a very Merry Christmas or a Happy Yule, depending on how you prefer to view it. So, but, you know.
All right. Okay. Well, great. I'll be back very soon with Semi Ogog. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'll probably have like a 10-minute break just to cool down. But I'll be back very soon with him. In the meantime, Zurius, it was really good to have you on the channel again. I mean, you used to be on quite a bit in like 2015, 2016, on quite a few hangouts. But it's been a long time, so thank you. And I think a lot of people will have enjoyed this. So, okay, we'll call it a night for now on this.
All right, thanks very much. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.